The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of its hosts, guests, or callers, and do not necessarily represent the opinions of WTBR-FM, its management, other producers, or sponsors.
Welcome to Living Well into the Future with your host, Julie B. Adler, where we introduce you to guests of all generations whose lived experience and expertise informs and stimulates us toward discussions and actions that foster living well ourselves and in our communities. As we continue to explore the topic of communities and culture, we will again be speaking with passionate and energetic musicians who employ the power of music to enhance individual lives and more broadly create communities. You can listen to past episodes on the WTBRFM.com website, Apple Podcasts, Audible Podcasts, and wherever you get your podcasts. Follow us and continue to write to us to let us know if their content gave rise to discussions or actions on your part. Let us know which episodes were relevant to your life, what you want to hear more about. You can reach us through our website, livingwellintothefuture.net, where you can get more information about our guests, show notes, and information about past episodes. Write to us at lytf22@gmail.com.
Thank you. I'm your host, Julie B. Adler. In this episode, we're going to return to Ryan LaBoy, who you heard in our last episode. Ryan is based in Pittsfield, Massachusetts, where he serves as artistic director of the Berkshire Children's Chorus and Berkshire Concert Choir. We will be focusing on the work he's doing to obtain his doctorate at Teachers College, Columbia University. His work is at the intersection of community arts and public health, more particularly the advent of social prescribing in Massachusetts and the United States. Today, we'll also present to you Dr. Penny Roberts, distinguished music therapist with over two decades of experience and degrees of piano pedagogy, music therapy, and aging. As you listen to Ryan and Penny, you might think about how music therapy and social prescribing are different, how they might benefit someone in your family. Would you like to see it in your community? Let's find out more about it. Dr. Penny Roberts works as a music therapist in a variety of roles and a variety of settings. So we'll start by exploring how she earned her expertise. Welcome, Penny Roberts, to Living Well into the Future.
Could you start by telling us how your interest in music therapy developed and evolved?
My bachelor's in piano pedagogy was at Loyola New Orleans, and I had a big piano scholarship. And although Loyola had a music therapy program at that time, I was locked into majoring in piano of some kind. Once I graduated and opened my own piano teaching studio, I noticed that I was more interested in students who were not typical learners than the students who were. So I had several kids with special needs and learning difficulties, and some adults as well that wanted to learn piano but had challenges in learning. And those were the students I was most excited about. So I did a little bit more research and thinking and decided to finish my master's degree in music therapy, and that was at Florida State in Tallahassee. And then life took us over to Los Angeles. All music therapists have to complete 1,000-ish hours of internship, and mine was in hospice and palliative care. And I found my love then, and most of my work was with older adults at several different facilities. And I really felt that although I was a clinician and was on the floor with my patients and residents, that I couldn't advocate for them at the same level as administrators, and recognized then that if I wanted to see change for greater numbers of older adults, that I would have to go back, learn more, and have those three letters behind my name. So that took me back to New Orleans and to Tulane School of Medicine, where I finished my PhD in interdisciplinary studies in aging, focusing on what is the aging process? What happens to our mind, body, spirit on a cellular level, on a cultural level, on a society level, and learning how that works. Now I am still in New Orleans and finding myself doing a mixture of things, using all those degrees.
In one of your roles, you work with individual patients in a hospital setting. Could you start by telling us how music therapists work with individual patients?
Do you use a piano? Do you use recorded music? How does that work?
All music therapists must be proficient in piano, guitar, and voice. So I'm a classical pianist, and now I play the guitar every day. If you are an oboist, fantastic. We want you to continue to be an excellent oboist, and you're going to need to learn to play the piano and the guitar, and you're going to need to learn to sing. The number one rule of music therapy is patient-preferred music, regardless of the genre. If I go in to see a patient whose first love is reggae, then I'm going to be learning some reggae music and I'm going to bring that back with me next time. So in that way, music therapists have to know a lot of music, a lot of styles, a lot of genres, a lot of years, all of those sorts of things. Sometimes it is me playing. Sometimes it is the patient playing. It's not a theory, but a definition of music therapy is using music for non-musical goals. So when I go in, I'm not trying to make you a concert pianist. Maybe we use the piano because you're working on fine motor control. Maybe you've had some sort of issue and have trouble utilizing each one of your fingers. In that way, playing the piano would be a perfect intervention to address the goal of fine motor control. If you are working with gross motor issues, I might use two or three drums, and we might work on coordinating left hand and right hand. It depends on what issue the patient presents. And then my job is to design a musical intervention to address those goals. I could talk about this forever, Julie. I really love my work.
It really shows. You work in so many areas.
In hospice, palliative care, oncology, children, and adolescents. What does that actually mean in terms of the work you're doing today? Where do you use your skills?
The work today is at University Medical Center and also at Ochsner Hospital System here in New Orleans and working with patients in oncology. So some are individual visits, as I said, at UMC, and nurses refer patients to music therapy. And this is important to know because not everybody needs music therapy. The referrals need to be focused on a central issue that the patient is working with. Sometimes that's pain. Sometimes that's anxiety, depression. Family dynamics is a big one in chronic illness. So that's on an individual level. And then groups are focused sometimes on survivorship. A patient is a survivor from the moment they are diagnosed. However, after diagnosis, we're looking at things like self-identity. How do I change now that I have a diagnosis like this? Is my body different once I start undergoing treatment? How is my definition of a mother, a caregiver, a daughter, an aunt, a sister? All of those are likely to change with diagnosis. So in a group session, we might do things like lyric analysis, where I bring in a song and print out the lyrics, listen to it and say, is this relevant to your life right now? Is there anything that you're taking from this lyric analysis? Who are you in relationship to this song? Process those things that come up with a cancer diagnosis and gain, hopefully, insight, strength, and encouragement from the lyric analysis itself.
So it crosses so many different needs when you're talking about oncology, when you're talking about just the general aging process, or a child who has ADHD or autism or things like that. Were those the children that you worked with in the early days?
Absolutely. Worked a lot in the autism community, also with kids and young adults with Down syndrome and Rett syndrome and all kinds of very specific and unusual diagnoses. In that case, it might be impulse control. So I play the drum, now you play the drum. Oops, not your turn yet, right? So working on impulse in that way, again, using music to address that non-musical goal.
And I saw in something that I read about you that you indicated working with children is especially difficult because each day is a new day. They don't seem to retain the lessons, if it's a lesson. Is that something that you found in your practice?
I think each day is a new day for all of us. And I can go in with a beautifully detailed and specific session plan and it go completely off the rails and we do something entirely different because that's how my client presents in that moment.
So you really have to be attuned. Is this something that they're incorporating in hospices or nursing facilities or things like that?
Absolutely. Lots of research is published in nursing journals on how to use music effectively on the floor and in the units. Hospices use music therapists regularly. And that's a whole nother conversation on the requirements for hospice from Medicare and Medicaid. It is not a requirement to employ a music therapist in hospice the way it is to employ RNs and physicians and so on and so forth. However, hospices see and have seen the value of music therapy and hire music therapists at their own expense because they see the difference it makes in patient care.
That's very interesting.
It's really cool.
You've gotten to this, but on the how and where is music therapy used, does the type of music used differ by age, setting, pathology, or all of the above?
Yes, all of the above. Again, it's patient preferred music. So if I'm working with a patient who is very identified with a specific culture, then the responsibility is mine to learn that music and to learn how I can be most effective using that music. If I am working with a population of folks who love hip hop, for example, that's not something that I can recreate. I might choose to use recorded music and the approach will change because of that population. It really depends on what the patient presents with, who they are, and what they need.
That seems very intensive. Like to really use it broadly, there would have to be an army of music therapists. Are there?
Yes, actually, yes. We are increasing every year in number and in scope. And we have the American Music Therapy Association, which is our professional association that makes the requirements for or works in conjunction to make requirements for education and professional development.
And is that the body to which you're speaking at Lincoln Center shortly?
That is not associated with any of our professional organizations. It's just Lincoln Center. I'm very excited about that. Lincoln Center has an accessibility program. So making sure that high quality music is available to all people. Part of that program is Lincoln Center Moments, which is specifically for people with dementia and their caregivers.
Wow.
It's really cool. It's a really cool program. They have both in-person and online offerings. So for people in North Dakota that can't get to Lincoln Center, we're making this available. And it is a, again, high quality performance. It might be theater, it might be opera, it might be jazz. And after that performance, the audience of folks with dementia and their caregivers engage in an art experience that really brings home the idea of the performance. So for Barber of Seville, for example, Rossini's opera, which is all about communication. And there's a note that gets passed from one person to another that changes everything. We might engage our audience in a discussion about identity or love, or what note would you write and to whom, to really bring home the message and embody the idea of the artistic experience. It's beautiful.
Have you done this before?
No, I'm brand new. I'll be doing two online and two in-person engagements.
They have hired you
to co-facilitate, yes. And that's the other cool thing about the program is that some of us are music therapists. Some of us are actors. Some of us are dancers. Some of us are choreographers. So in that way, it's an interdisciplinary engagement. So I won't be working with another music therapist. I'll be working with a visual artist or a sculptor or an actor to see how can we work together to bring this experience to this audience. It's really good stuff.
But then you've just been appointed acting head of music therapy at Louisiana State?
It's LSU. Our friend and colleague passed away unexpectedly just a few weeks ago. And so they found themselves in need of an interim chair. And so I'm glad to be able to help both the university and the students make their way through the program, be sure that they get what they need and feel really supported as they navigate this loss.
Does that involve teaching as well as administering?
Yes.
What do you teach?
That's a good question. How to be a music therapist. So kids that are students that come in, we have to teach them, of course, piano, guitar, voice, as we talked about before. Those are classes, as well as how do you conduct a music session with drums? How do you conduct a music session with a piano? How do you use your instrument in a therapeutic manner? How do you conduct a session where we're doing guided imagery with music? So all of the techniques needed to be a music therapist. And then importantly, we have to combine those musical elements with psychological elements. Again, what's happening in the body, mind, spirit, what's happening neurologically. But what do you do when you're working with a patient with depression who mentions suicidal ideation? How do we process that? What then do you need to do to be safe with your patient? Knowing the psychological processes of what comes up in a musical experience is essential. We all have those associations. One minute you're in the grocery store, the music comes on, and the next you are in a car when you're 14, right? We all have that. What does that bring up within me that I might need help with processing? Essential. Another thing that music therapists have to know, we have to know the theory. We have to know the history. We have to know the nuts and bolts of the music itself to be able to play it and create it appropriately. So the other day, a patient asked me for Stevie Wonder. Okay, if I play Stevie Wonder, you're going to feel worse when I leave than before I arrive. I have to know how to be able to do that appropriately to get to reach the goal that we're working towards.
So what did you do in that case?
We listened to Stevie Wonder from a computer instead of me trying to play it.
So what you're really telling me is that you are a musician first. You have the skills, you have the background, you have the knowledge of the intricacy.
Correct.
And the facility to convey it to an audience of one or more than one.
Correct. And we receive lots of inquiries from well-meaning people who say, I love music and I want to be a music therapist. Do you play an instrument? No. And you can't be a music therapist, right? And again, it's what I was referencing before is some music is better than no music. However, this is a very specific skill set, as you mentioned earlier. And it also requires flexibility with what you know how to do and then how to make that therapeutic for others.
We've spoken about your work with individual patients as a teacher at Lincoln Center, and still you find time to fit more into your schedule. You have Crescent Penny Cultural Programs. What is that?
That's the name of my company that allows me to be everywhere at once. As you said, there are lots of pieces to this puzzle. One of the jobs that I have is working with the New Orleans Musicians Clinic. And that is another very super cool opportunity. They are the only clinic in the nation that serves exclusively musicians. In the musician economy, it's a gig economy. We work nights. We do gigs on the weekends. We play weddings. Often don't have health insurance. This was formed specifically to serve that very important community in New Orleans. And musicians suffer from performance anxiety. We suffer from depression and anxiety and family dynamics and all of those other things. So using music specifically to meet the needs of the musician community is the role that I'm happy to have at the Musicians Clinic.
These people could be any age.
Yes, absolutely.
all of the many ways in which you're applying your skills raises the question that I think our listeners might be asking themselves. What is the inherent power of music? Are there universals of sound, tempo, resonance? What makes the magic of music?
That's a big question. Yeah. We know that, again, it's patient preferred. So something that motivates me might not motivate you. Something that relaxes me might not relax my spouse. So making sure that music is specialized and tailored, curated really to the person and need is the first thing to keep in mind. To that end, music is a neurological process within itself. What is happening to the brain when we're listening to music versus when we're playing music? Then we go to what's happening to our brains when we're listening to music and driving, when we're listening to music and cleaning, when we're playing the piano versus playing the clarinet. So these are questions that research is starting to address in conjunction with neurologists to see what is happening. How do we then take that information and use it therapeutically? I'm not sure that answers your question.
It's exceedingly interesting. I saw a one-hour interview between Walter Isaacson and John Batiste from the Aspen Health Conference from 2017. And John Batiste talked about going into hospitals and places like that and playing different sounds, different rhythms, different kinds of music, and how those things would make people feel in different ways.
Mm-hmm.
So is that part of your toolkit? I'm going to play fast notes. I'm going to play slow notes. I'm going to play low notes or high notes.
Yes, absolutely. So starting with where is the patient right now? Where do they want to go? Where do they need to go? So if I'm working with a patient who is about to have surgery and is very anxious, I'm going to meet them where they are musically. Fast heart rate, fast respiration. Meet them with that fast rhythm and then gradually change that to get them where they need to be. So gradually slow down, gradually change the dynamic level to quieter. By the same token, I've been in hospice situations where everybody has gathered to say goodbye to grandma and grandma's asleep. So then my job is to go in and meet grandma where she is and play music that is slower, that is quieter, and gradually increase and change those musical elements, melody, harmony, dynamics, all of those kinds of things, to wake up grandma. And by the time I leave, she's alert and oriented and able to communicate with her family, who has all gathered to see her.
Wow. And music has the power to do that.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
That's quite remarkable. Is there something in resonance or timbre that causes a physiological response?
Yes, using music has been around since day one, really, if we think about it in that way. It's always a part of public presentation. It has been a part of healing for eons. Yes, there is an intuitive feeling that we can use music to respond. And what you're talking about, whether it's the Tibetan singing bowls or Tibetan bells, there's sound baths and sound healing ceremonies that combine intuition with kind of what we know about how the body can respond. There is a whole group of people who believe in resonance of certain pitches and that they align with parts of the body, mind, and spirit. That's another application. While it's not music therapy, it's valuable as well. And what you were talking about with John Batiste, for musicians who go into communities, hospitals, facilities, and play music, there's absolute brilliance and importance in that as well.
But it's not music therapy, which is a discipline as opposed to cultural tradition or something like that.
Correct.
Okay. Is there anything that I didn't ask you that I should ask you about music therapy and its application?
I think it's important and valuable for people to know that it is covered by some insurances, and in some states, it's also reimbursable. So investigating that can be really valuable for patients to clients. It is in school systems. It can be a part of an IEP, individualized education program. So for people that have kids with special needs, they can add music therapy to their IEP.
And for our listeners who don't have special applications, but would like to incorporate some of the principles that we've talked about into their own lives, what ideas do you have for them?
Sure. There are a couple of things that I think would be helpful. The first is a paper by Dr. Jean Cohen. It was specifically looking at arts engagement with older adults.
We'll put a reference to that creativity and aging study by Jean Cohen in our show notes, which you can find at livingwellintothefuture.net.
And so they placed older adults into several groups. One was music, one was poetry writing, another was storytelling, I think. And I think there was one that was even maybe attending museums. And they found that arts engagement, strictly engagement, not for therapeutic purposes at all, ended up having therapeutic results. So fewer doctor visits, fewer falls, less medication taken, all these kinds of things. So the takeaway from that is that engaging with the arts is healthy for the body, mind, and spirit. And this can mean attending a concert. This can mean going to a museum. This can mean being part of a book club. So that's the first thing, is intentional engagement. We have to be intentional about what we're consuming, especially these days where media is everywhere, like it or not, and you can accidentally consume it. So being purposeful and intentional about how it feeds you and how it informs your life is first and foremost. The second thing that I think to distinguish engagement from music therapy, is there a purpose that you're trying to meet? Am I cleaning the house? If I'm cleaning the house, then Brahms probably won't help me, right? It might be more Mozart. It might be Rachmaninoff. I may need to be angry when I'm cleaning the sink, right? What is the goal I want music to help me achieve? And then what is the music that would get me there? We were talking about a hospice patient who is here and we want them here. It's the same way. Maybe I'm starting cleaning the house at the front and it's going to be slow here. And by the time I get here, I'm going to get in the shower and go out for a cocktail. What is it that I'm moving towards? And what is the music that can support me getting there? It's really just very practical. Thinking about being in the car, what am I listening to? I can't listen to classical music in the car. I'll drive off the road. I'm too involved in what's happening. I have to be really intentional. Again, that word is, I think, very valuable in thinking about sound and music in life.
And I think we do that unconsciously.
Mm-hmm.
But what you're suggesting is a little consciousness, intentionality,
right,
in terms of what we're doing.
Exactly. Turn the volume just a little bit on your awareness and see how your body, mind, spirit responds.
Thank you, Penny Roberts, for speaking with us today. I can see why you love your work. It's a 360-degree career and employs all of your skills.
Thank you. It's wonderful to still be learning. I didn't know that at 50, I would still be learning, and I'm so glad to be. I hope it never ends.
Our discussion with Dr. Penny Roberts about how to employ music in our lives leads directly to the work of Ryan Jose LaBoy, who you heard in our last episode. Ryan, artistic director, a singer, conductor, and community musician, is engaging in work for his doctorate at Teachers College, Columbia University. His work deals with matters at the intersection of health and music. He's particularly looking at social prescribing,
which listeners heard about in our earlier discussion with Dr. Joel Katz and others at the Dana-Farber Cancer Center. You can find that discussion on WTBR-FM, Apple Podcasts, Audible, and wherever you get your podcasts. Welcome, Ryan.
I'm at Teachers College, Columbia University, and my degree type is a Doctor of Education in Music and Music Education. One of the great things about Teachers College as an institution is they take a very liberal definition of what education means. Teachers College is audacious in its research agenda, that it opens an opportunity for somebody like me to come in, who is no longer affiliated with a college or university, who is no longer teaching within a K-12 system. And so you think, why the heck is this guy studying music education? Because I am teaching directly in a community, and community music is its own sort of branch of music education. Vocationally, something that is important to me is that I have these ensembles in my community, here the Berkshire Children's Chorus and the Berkshire Concert Choir, and beyond the trappings of academia, what am I teaching people about life? What is the function of this? And at that point that I applied to the program, we were just emerging from the pandemic. What does this moment of the pandemic invite us to bring to the foreground in terms of the function of a music education and a life in music? And for me, that quickly became health and well-being, our social health and our mental health and well-being. And there's already people who are doing amazing work in this area at the intersection of community health and the arts. And so there are a number of arts and health labs that have popped up across the United States in the past 5 to 10 years. And serendipity, here I am in Massachusetts, and through the work of the Mass Cultural Council, other folks have already begun pilot work and now actual enactment of social prescribing here in Massachusetts. So it just seemed like the right time for me to be asking these questions about the way that singing can help us improve our lives together. One of the most important things foundationally about social prescribing is that it is non-clinical. It's embedded directly in a community context. And so this is a really profound opportunity to asking questions about how can singing in my community choir be in service of my mental and social health. And within the field of social prescribing, as it's emerging, there's plenty of question around, you know, we have this good thing going, but how do we sort of systematize it or formalize it?
If it is functioning in Massachusetts, how you would connect to it?
Yeah, social prescribing is absolutely functioning in Massachusetts. Massachusetts as a state did social prescribing pilot work from 2019 until 2022, I think, 21, 22, across the pandemic, which must have been incredibly challenging. At this point, it is live in the state, but it's not live entirely across the state. It's not found its way westward. And we are as far west as you get here in Berkshire County. I think we have every reason to be optimistic within social prescribing as a policy within the state of Massachusetts here in the Berkshires, because we already have an abundance of resource, which is really incredible to know. So social prescribing, the work that has been done, there's a bifurcation within it that you can look at social prescribing as either an active participant in or a passive recipient of. So for example, somebody may be singing in my choir, and that counts as social prescribing. They're very actively involved. Or perhaps somebody is doing a dance class with Jacob's Pillow, or maybe that would be active, participatory engagement with social prescribing. But on the other side of social prescribing, there's also the important work that, like, the Clark did some really cool, novel stuff in their piloting of social prescribing a couple of years ago, where you give folks tickets to a museum or a gallery or tickets to see a show. Part of what social prescribing aims to do is to offer as wide an array of programs and opportunities as we can, because it places agency, meaning patient agency, at the center of practice.
Looking at social prescribing.
Since we know that the arts benefit society, what triggers a person's eligibility? Where would this come into play? The example of the gym membership is everybody who gets insurance gets at a certain age, gets that.
Right.
Who gets the right to have their choir fees paid for, or their attendance at the ballet paid for, or whatever it is.
Yeah, and I think the answer to that differs if we're speaking pragmatically versus if we're speaking altruistically. Like, I think an aim of the social prescribing movement in the spirit of altruism is to say, everybody gets their choir membership paid for. It doesn't matter if you live in Massachusetts, if you live in Texas, if you live in Pennsylvania, if you live in the country, if you live in a city, if you live in a suburb, if you are singing in a community chorus, which, by the way, is one of the most popular recreational activities in the United States, then you get your membership dues paid for. I would say that is certainly an aim. But we have to bear in mind that systematically, social prescribing is very much in its infancy. So I'm going to use my state as an example. Massachusetts just started piloting social prescribing policy and practice in 2019. That's 5-6 years ago at this point. That is so new still. And so at this point, the pragmatic answer to your question about who has access to it is the people who live in places where this policy and practice is being developed. That is who has access to it at this point. But I don't think by any means that the hope is to limit it in that way. I think the hope is to grow it.
I still am trying to get my mind around the fact that these things would be paid for by someone, government or the insurance company, without a personal recognized need, because the cost would be astronomical.
The cost is minimal compared to what we're paying into health insurance now, or what the health insurance companies pay now. I disagree with that, Julie. Paying, for example, in my community chorus, it is less than $100 for a 14-week cycle. That is pennies in the bucket compared to 14 weeks of physical therapy for a health insurance company. So in Canada, for example, there is a statistic that for every $1 invested in social prescribing, it is over $4 that is saved by the healthcare system. In actuality, this is a huge savings in this shift of paradigm to the cost of healthcare. Yeah, so it seems like where the analogy of the gym membership is maybe falling short in our conversation, and perhaps this is my steering it this way, is that we are not yet at a place where it is universal in that way. So that's like the altruistic goal or aim of social prescribing is, wouldn't that be great if just like your health insurance paid for whatever community arts or culture activity you wanted to do? But I want to be clear, that's not where social prescribing lives today. Social prescribing is an institution that needs somebody with prescription power to actually write that prescription for a patient. There's gatekeeping involved. And the extent to which gatekeeping is a healthy versus a hurtful thing is something to be debated. But I just want to be really clear that there's a difference when what would be like pie in the sky, the utopian version of what social prescribing looks like in society, compared to where it is in its infancy, certainly in the United States today.
What are the characteristics or needs today when social prescribing would be triggered?
So one of the characteristics is contextual. You need to be living in a context where the desire to push forward this policy or program currently exists. So that context needs to be a given. That's not universal. So say you are living in that context, the question of who then qualifies for that. When somebody's going into their doctor's office, physicians are required to do a measure of depression screening, for example, and just like baseline wellness checking. And if it is determined in that context that a patient has low to moderate levels of either depression or anxiety, they're suffering from loneliness. I think one of the primary interests has to do with blood pressure as well. So if somebody has high blood pressure, they might be a good candidate for receiving a social prescription. At this point, I don't know that there are any caveats around like age or socioeconomic status or things like that, but those are some of the initial triggers. Social prescribing is a non-clinical intervention, which means that if you have moderate or higher levels of need, you need a qualified clinician to be tending to that. But if you're coming in and you're feeling like lonely and starting to show signs of depression, or are feeling anxious, at a moderate level within your daily life, you might be a really good candidate for a social prescription. Once you receive that social prescription, there's one of two ways. There's both a direct and an indirect pathway that prescription can be satisfied. So in the direct pathway, that physician themselves, that clinician, whoever you are seeing, would write you a prescription and hand that over to whatever arts or cultural organization you are going to engage with. So that's the physician directly connecting to the community resource, which for our purposes is an arts or a cultural institution. In an indirect social prescribing relationship, which I think is more the norm, is the physician writes you a prescription if you've met these sort of criteria for a candidacy. And then you take that to what you can think of as a community care navigator. They give you that prescription and send you to a care navigator or a link worker. And that person does anywhere from a 30 to 60 minute intake with you.
As I understood it from the doctors speaking about it in terms of recovering patients and things like that, benefits accrue if you attend a performance as well as participate in one.
Yeah, that would be the difference between participatory and receptive social prescribing or arts activities, cultural activities. Within the literature, one thing that I appreciate is that's where the distinction between arts and culture lies. Arts activity implies more direct participation in the activity. That's your dance class, that's your guitar lesson, that's your choir, your community choir. Whereas on the cultural side of things, that would be representative of receptive prescription, where I'm going to a gallery to see this beautiful exhibit, or I have tickets to go to a theater production or to a musical or to an orchestra concert. And so both do exist. Yeah, it seems that there is a certain threshold at which there are discernible differences between the amount of benefit offered in either of those streams, whether it's me going to a choir concert or me participating in a choir. And I think the reasonable assumption is that participating in the choir is going to represent a larger health benefit. But what the literature textures for us is perhaps that's true up until a certain point, and I can't remember these measures off the top of my head, but past a certain threshold, there's not really a discernible difference or a distinguishable difference between if Ryan is attending a choir concert versus Ryan singing in a choir. And so both are beneficial, and early on, they're differently beneficial, but then there's this plateau effect.
Oh, that's very interesting.
Isn't that fascinating? Yeah.
Yes.
As a practitioner, my wild assumption would be what I just said, that obviously singing in the choir is going to be more beneficial. And that's not to say that singing in the choir is not beneficial. It is. It's just, it is also beneficial to be in the audience listening to the choir.
So let's get back to the process of obtaining a social prescription.
The care navigator's job in that in-depth interview context is to help suss out what matters to you. When's the last time that you remember feeling joy? Or when you were a child, what sort of activities made you feel happy or satisfied? And through that conversation, you learn, oh, this person used to play guitar in a rock band when he was a kid. And that was a really fulfilling experience for him. And that's how he met some of his friends. And I learned that this person became the best man at his wedding, etc. And so through that in-depth interview process, the care navigator, who is perceived to be an expert on what the available community resources are, says, I'll just use my name as an example. Ryan, I hear you saying that music was a really important piece of your life growing up, and it sounds like you're no longer engaging in music right now. There are these four different music activities within our community. One of them is a choir. One of them is a group guitar class. One of them is, I don't know, we'll say bucket drumming. And one of them is playing in the community wind ensemble. And so of these four things that could satisfy this prescription you received from your doctor, which one sounds the most interesting to you? Which one excites you to participate and sounds like it might get at what matters to you so that we can start to alleviate some of these symptoms that you're feeling in terms of social disconnection or isolation or loneliness? And so then together, and this is an important caveat that we see emerging within the social prescribing discourse, is that the link worker and the patient are co-producing that prescription together. So it's not the community care navigator saying, I think you should sing in the community choir. That community care navigator is knowledgeable enough about the arts and cultural offerings in their community to lay out the options for that particular patient and to give them agency to the extent that it's feasible, because not every community has those four different types of activities that I named for. So to the extent that it's feasible, give that person agency in choosing what intervention is going to work best for them. My research is looking at the next step. Right now, I think what we need more than a generalized understanding is we need a close-up personal interrogation of experiences of the artists doing this work in Massachusetts in particular, because we are the first to try it and do it at the state level. So what happens to my role in society as an artist? How does that change? How do I experience it when this opportunity to do that art in service of community health and well-being is introduced as a possibility?
Fascinating question. Well, thanks
for validating my research, but I think we have to start there. So you've gone to your primary care physician in indirect social prescribing. They've written you a prescription. That then gets you an in-depth intake with a community care navigator. You co-produce this prescription, you fill out the rest of it, and then that link worker hands you off to whatever the community arts or culture activity is, and you engage in that activity. Oftentimes, that is where the literature stops on social prescribing. In some ways, and this is maybe an overstatement, but again, this is entirely my opinion and being new to the field of social prescribing, but it gets wrapped up like a happily ever after. And then Ryan joined the chorus and he was no longer lonely. I just don't believe that happy ending should be accepted uncritically, because there's a lot of things that go into providing that experience from the activity leaders or the community artist perspective that then lead to these health benefits or these well-being outcomes. Me going to join a community choir doesn't automatically mean that my health and well-being is going to be improved. And the kind of choir that I join, or the kind of conductor who leads that choir and their temperament, their aesthetic values, how they hold that in balance with this emerging question of the way that we can also address health and well-being in our choirs. Like, those are also variable and site-specific that my desire through my dissertation research is to bring a lens of criticality to that and saying, in part, what are the conditions within social prescribing that lead to these outcomes? And more specifically, what do these activities have to say about their experiences with this? I was not personally trained in social prescribing or music therapy, and yet here I am opting into a social prescribing program where I'm helping to address somebody's health and well-being. Do I feel like I have the tools I need to be successful doing that? And if I do, what are those tools? Is that the same toolkit as the conductor down the block? We just don't know. Do I feel like I'm being under-supported? And while I really would love to be a force for good in improving somebody's health and well-being, I actually feel like a fraud or an imposter and like I'm failing them because I'm not a clinician, I'm not a music therapist, and I'm very aware of that. We just don't have an accounting yet of that disposition within the literature. And so my dissertation aims to begin documenting that. How do we, as the cultural and arts sector, those of us who are providing these activities, how do we experience social prescribing? Maybe it's a very welcome thing. Maybe it's a kind of stressful thing. There's just no way to know at this point. The literature doesn't fully account for it. There's a small handful of studies that do have some to say about this, but I want to understand not only what the arts leader themselves is experiencing, but what sense they make of that, irrespective of what the literature says and irrespective of what the policy says, because they're the ones who are the street level bureaucrats, right? They are the ones who are making sense of policy in action and using subjective judgment in order to enact it. So there's just lots of gray area still. And I think the field is very new and there's just not an accounting of it.
Fascinating. Right?
Thanks, Ryan, for your explanations of the state of social prescribing today. I'll look forward to seeing how your study in the field of social prescribing develop. But before we end, I have a question, the answer of which has been elusive. What in music creates the beneficial reactions we've been talking about?
I can try. I remember saying this to a group of my college students, and I had to preface it by saying that I wasn't stoned. That's maybe a great way to start it here, which is We understand through scientific endeavor that all of life vibrates. If something is living, it is vibrating. The universe vibrates. And I'm just going to speak to my own experience. What makes collective singing so bonding for people, and pretty immediately, I mean, there are some studies on this too, is that sense of collective vibration. Because if you're vibrating, you are vital, you are alive. And so even though we use text, it is this wordless way of connecting to our aliveness together. Sure, I can sing at home by myself and I vibrate and I'm alive. But to be alive together in the company of others and to be vibrant and resonant, I think is part of why music is such a potent tool for our communities. Because I think just across society, many of us don't feel alive, living but not alive. And so what a privilege it is to be the keeper of that and to get groups of 30 to 90 people together on a weekly basis to be alive together. It doesn't necessarily matter what we're singing. Sidebar, it matters very much what we're singing. But just that we are singing and that we are vibrating together, I think is profoundly important.
Wow. I didn't expect that answer.
I don't mean to be exclusive again about singing, but I can just speak to my experience and I'm very passionate about it. What is so spectacular about singing is it doesn't require an instrument outside of yourself in order to get that vibration happening. It is vibration from within that is harvested out. I actually, last week in the concert choir rehearsal, I remember talking with my singers about singing is a superhuman or extra human activity. It truly is. Biologically, there is no reason why we need to sing. The muscles that make up the voice, their biological function is to keep us from swallowing either water or other food or other objects like down our windpipe and into our lungs so that we can continue living. As an incredible bonus of that, we can talk. And as a bonus of that, we can sing. And so when we come together, I mean, my gosh, it's so easy to feel like defeated and down. And right now, I think across generations, but we can take this superhuman gift, this thing that is extra human, and do it together. We're superheroes. That really is what it is. We are making the world more beautiful just by being together. I could wax poetic about this for days, but it really is spectacular to my mind that we can transcend the biological necessity for this instrument that is housed within us to then offer it as something beautiful and ephemeral for the world.
Well, that's gorgeous and shows your passion for what you do.
Thank you, Ryan LaBoy, for leaving us on such a high note. Mark your calendar so you don't forget to listen to our next episode when we turn our attention to how music defines and unites communities with Bonnie Buick Brown, first violinist in the Boston Symphony Orchestra. She's an arranger and member of two other groups, Child Play and Frame. Ryan LaBoy will return, as will Daniel Anastasio, who you may remember is a solo pianist and chamber music musician based in San Antonio, Texas. He's the artistic director of several nonprofit organizations, including Agorita and the Unheard of Ensemble. Mark your calendars so you don't forget to listen to our next episode when we turn our attention to how music defines and unites communities with Bonnie Buick Brown, first violinist in the Boston Symphony Orchestra, arranger and member of the groups Child's Play and Frame. Ryan LaBoy will return, as will Daniel Anastasio. He is a solo pianist and chamber music musician based in San Antonio, Texas. Artistic director of several nonprofit organizations, including Unheard of Ensemble. Our thanks from me, Julie B. Adler, to Berkshire Alley, WTBR-FM 89.7 Pittsfield, and the Berkshire
Eagle for their support.
We hope that you enjoyed this episode and found food for thought and further discussion with family, friends, and the wider community. If you want to repeat this episode and hear others, you can find them at Living Well Into the Future on 89.7 WTBR Pittsfield, 88.1 WSBR Lee, WTBRFM.com, Apple Podcasts, and other streaming services. Subscribe so you don't miss a single episode. We invite you to contribute to Living Well Into the Future with your comments and suggestions for topics and even guests. Write to us at lwitf22@gmail.com or through our website at livingwellintothefuture.com, where you can find show notes, past episodes, and information about our guests.
This podcast is produced by Julie Copenheffer. Our music is written and performed by Michael Copenheffer. The opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and not of WTBR-FM, Berkshire Ollie, or the Berkshire Eagle, or the LWITF production team.